Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's MBL on PRN.FM. This May 26, 2015 edition of Nature Bats Last comes live from the Mud Hut in New Mexico and also from Phoenix, Arizona. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week's show, we have artist and educator Daniel Dancer as our guest. We have some climate update information for you. We have Guy's Hate Mail, and we have Breaking Hopium, which we start with this week, coming from our regular contributor, Forrest Palmer, as he tackles the recently popularized phrase in Florida to deal with climate change, quote-unquote, "I'm not a scientist." Forrest?
I am not a scientist. This has become the new quote du jour amongst the right-wing factions in America as a response to any and all questions on climate change. The number of politicians who have said this are too numerous to count, since it has been repeated by people at the local, state, and federal. To deflect any probing questions regarding their personal stance on climate change. Therefore, in essence, it is a way of pleading the infamous Fifth Amendment by people in court or legal proceedings, where a person is not obliged to offer information to incriminate oneself. This refrain is laughable on the face of it because although I am not a forensic pathologist, if someone was to ask me what would be the end result of a person taking a 12-gauge shotgun blast in point-blank range to the face, I wouldn't hesitate to say that this person would certainly die, most likely instantaneously. I say this to illustrate that when something is so blatant, it doesn't take someone well-versed in a particular field to designate the inevitable outcome of an event. Therefore, scientific jargon, which is wholly necessary, mind you, deals with being able to explain a phenomenon in minute details. Still, the phenomenon itself, in many instances, is easy to ascertain for those willing to open their eyes, that is. Therefore, ignorance is not only bliss, but is the safest form of response amongst those who won't accept climate change. After decades of saying that climate change isn't true, while Rome continues to burn, and we all play a nice little tune on our collective fiddle as our world turns to smoldering embers, the right has reverted to feigned ignorance and unintelligence about what is and isn't the truth. Regarding the scientist quote and its usage, probably the most egregious regurgitation of it surrounds any number of prominent politicians in Florida. For instance, I give you Rick Scott. Rick Scott is the current governor of Florida, and this response was his tagline during the last election cycle in 2014. As you would think that the fact that Florida is the only ocean peninsula in the continental United States, and therefore surrounded by the rising water on all three sides, with this haphazard situation playing some part in a logical response to climate change, this is anything but the truth. The aforementioned Rick Scott, who is admittedly not a scientist, leads a state government that has made it policy to force its state workers to not use the term climate change while doing their jobs. Although this has been denied by Scott and his administration, where there is smoke, there is almost certainly fire. This is the height of lunacy, but evidently just indicative of the region as a whole, since the previous governor of Florida, one Jeb Bush, recently made the comment that people who accept climate science are arrogant. I think it is safe to assume that a prerequisite for holding the high state government position in Florida is to be a blithering idiot on pretty much everything, but specifically regarding the environmental catastrophe we see playing out before our eyes. To be specific about the sea level rise, though, rough estimates are that the oceans will potentially cause the U.S. coastline to rise up to 6 feet in many places by 2100. If we are still around as a species, then the fact that 2.4 million Florida residents and 1.3 million homes comprising half the risk nationwide of tide inundation as the sea levels rise means that Exodus won't just be a fantastic biblical fable, but a reality of dramatic proportions in the next few decades for Floridians. So we might want to look at this southern peninsula as a veritable hotbed regarding climate change. As a result of this unacknowledged situation by the people in the state, the ostrich defense of burying your head in the sand may soon be replaced with the fish defense of breathing underwater. And although I am not a scientist either, I don't think I need to tell any sane individual what will be the end result of this exercise in utter stupidity.
That was Forrest Palmer with Breaking Hopium. In the culture of make-believe, where idiocracy rules the day. We wind up breaking hopium with Alexis from Alexandria. Or maybe we don't.
This week in Cognitive Dissonance, I was treated to a 10-minute rant by a father who was celebrating the births of his 5 and 7-year-old sons by meditating on human extinction. I kid you not. So after meticulously outlining our climate predicament and our lack of political capital to address the problem, as well as our role as willing accomplices in the death cult of global capitalism, he wistfully considered the fate of his children, presuming that it was a problem for their lifetimes and not his, then summed it all up by saying that there was actually hope in extinction. Because other species have gone extinct before. I don't know. Happy birthday, boys. Mommy and Daddy got you a dead planet.
Thanks, Alexis. Before we kick off our primary interview, I'd like to bring attention to yesterday's post on the blog. You can find it near the top of the page at GuyMcPherson.com. It's a brief description of the workshop Pauline Schneider and I have developed. Additional details are available at the website dedicated to the workshop, onlylovemains.org. That's onlylovemains.org. It's our pleasure this week to interview Daniel Dancer. Daniel has an M.A. in child psychology and has devoted his professional life to working with children in a very unusual way. Working as a photojournalist in the 1980s, he became fascinated with sky art while traveling to Peru and encountering the famous Nazca lines. When he returned home, he began working with Kansas field artist Stan Hurd, who creates giant images on the earth by using a tractor as a paintbrush and crops for color. One day, Daniel decided to bring an entire elementary school out to perform as beads on the headband of a 25-acre Indian head. The result was stunning. 2 decades later, while visiting in Kansas, he ran into one of the bead kids who told him that the experience was the most memorable thing he did in school, that it taught him that our view of the world is too small, that a big picture view is essential. His comment led directly to the creation of Art for the Sky. Check it out at artforthesky.com. Welcome to the Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, Daniel Dancer.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with a thumbnail sketch of Art for the Sky. How did you start it up after the comment from the then-grown-up kid from the past, and where have you taken it? Where is it sitting today?
Well, that was 15 years ago when that happened, and I started out, you know, doing maybe one project the first year, and then this year is my busiest year so far when it's just exploding. I have so many people that want to do it. I've been to 6 countries and 40 states, almost 200 projects. Largest one was 5,000 people, and it's pretty exciting how it's just really catching on. The 6 teachings and what people get out of it—it's pretty exhilarating where it's gone from that comment of a grown-up elementary school kid.
That's very impressive. 40 states and 6 countries, all within a relatively short period of time. That's quite an explosion of interest within the last 6 years or so.
15 years, yeah.
Wow. Ultimately, you're a teacher, and that's what you're trying to do with these kids, is teach. What are the fundamental concepts you're trying to convey with your teaching?
Well, there's 6 teachings, and their intention, you know, what the universe, I think, wants to collaborate with us, and it just needs to know what we want. So we always set our intention for good weather. And of all those projects, I've only been rained out once. So that seems to work. And the other next teaching is interconnection. You know, we're all connected together. We need everybody to show up in these designs, or it will be missing part of its body if it's an animal, which it usually is. And that's a great metaphor for how nature works. We need all our ecosystems to be working and functional. And what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. That's one of the big teachings about interconnection. All the images are impermanent. That's the next teaching. It's very temporary art, maybe only perfect for 15 minutes. Everything is constantly changing. We're all going to die someday. And the short duration of these images help us appreciate every single moment as being extremely special. So that's a powerful teaching for the kids when they learn that, you know, when a kindergarten learns that they're going to die someday, they all kind of look at each other like, well, nobody told me that. So that gets home in a powerful way. The next teaching is gratitude. Every image is a great big thank you to the earth and sky for all the blessings we get every single day, things that we usually take for granted. And it's also an apology for our impacts upon the earth. That's something new that I've worked into the teachings. And I start out each program by apologizing to the whole school, to all these young kids, for the kind of earth that they've inherited from us adults. Let's see, the next teaching, I want to make sure I don't leave anything out, is collaboration. Incredibly powerful what you can do when you collaborate together with, you know, 200, 500, 5,000 people all working on the same thing. So it's a huge teaching of what we can do when we collaborate together. And of course, the biggest teaching, which I think you're interested in, we've talked about this, is awakening our sky sight. And I can talk about that for a second if you want to go into more detail.
Yeah, that's, Daniel, this is Mike, guys, co-host. That's the part that really interests me is the sky sight, and I've never really heard it put that way. And I think it's a perfect way to describe, especially to young people, the lack of foresight in some of the decisions we, as you mentioned, adults have made and have impacted their future. And I was wondering how you kind of approach that with them.
Right. Well, a couple of years. Well, first of all, I think the way we perceive the world is faulty. It's obsolete. And it's rapidly proving to be our fatal flaw.
Right.
And we could get away with it with a little bit less impact when we were less in number and before we began burning fossil fuels. And yet, philosopher Immanuel Kant, father of holistic thinking, saw this fault in our perception 200 years ago when he wrote, and I came upon this quote a couple of years after I was doing Art for the Sky, and it's been sort of my guiding foundational inspiring quote, so to speak. He said that for peace to reign on earth, humans must evolve into new beings who have learned to see the whole first.
Right.
Learn to see the whole first. Seeing the whole first means seeing through the eyes of everything, taking the whole earth and every ecosystem into account with every decision we make. It means seeing through the eyes of future generations. And I call this whole first way of seeing our sky sight, And awakening it is our only hope for a chance of human beings being around a few hundred years from now. And if we can't evolve this way of perceiving the world, and like I started out, I think it will be our fatal flaw. And back in the 60s and 70s, there's this concept called the seventh generation concept. You don't hear it. It was very popular when the environmental movement was getting going. You don't hear it very often. And, you know, our Constitution was based in part on the governing structure of the Iroquois Confederacy, which included the Mohawk Nation. And I've got a little Mohawk blood in me, so I'm especially keen on this. And that's where the seventh generation concept came from. And the notion, of course, and I'm sure you guys are aware of it, and many of your listeners probably are, is every decision must be made so that it doesn't negatively affect the seventh generation.
Right.
And we left that part out of the Constitution, unfortunately. And, you know, just imagine how different our country would be if we had left that in. So that's a similar version of a sky sight.
Right. It seems like, you know, for most of human history, we've had sky sight. And, you know, over the last 12,000 years with the development of civilization, we've kind of lost it. And I guess your point of taking it out of the Constitution is a perfect example of that.
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with you. I was thinking about this earlier. I don't think that perhaps we've ever had it. We've never really needed to have it because we were small in number and it was okay to be short-sighted because we were very survival-oriented. We, you know... So it's kind of debatable how much of it we've had, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I might argue that we stayed small numbers for exactly that reason.
Yeah, maybe so. You know, when we discovered oil, our sky sight, if we did have it, just sort of disappeared. We put our blinders on because we could make so much money and we could do all these incredible things.
Right, yeah. It's a good discussion to have. I agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting you bring up the Iroquois Confederation. When I was teaching on campus, I would mention the influence of the development of the United States Constitution, and invariably students would say, no, that can't be right. They'd never heard of such a thing by the time they were juniors and seniors in college, and because the indoctrination was so complete by that time, they didn't believe it. And no amount of evidence would convince them, which is pretty interesting, and I find frequently that sort of response from people who have been embedded within the dominant paradigm for long enough. After a while, you can't even use any amount of evidence to convince people of reality.
Right, it's that old thing, you repeat a lie often enough, and you know, it becomes the truth, and especially in the days of the internet where it's hard to know what to believe, and there's so much information out there. My God, it's confusing for kids growing up.
Right, and we don't require a media literacy or a media criticism course, as is required, I think, in every country in Western Europe.
And is that right?
So it's pretty astonishing that, you know, students are not taught critical thinking. By the time they get out of high school in Western Europe, everybody has been exposed to media criticism, and that's why advertising isn't nearly as effective there as is in the United States. Here you can put up anything. You can put up, you know, cigarettes and beer on television, and people think it's good for them.
Yeah, sad but true.
I'd like you to unpack one of my favorite expressions of yours. You say the highest purpose of art is to write point on the front line of consciousness change, to create a field for the never before seen to happen. End quote. What do you mean by that? Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I love the term never before seen, which I first heard from a teacher of mine, Martin Prechtel. He's a kind of a Mayan shaman. Amazing dude. But I think through the ages, and especially now, much of what we call art has served mostly to support rather than challenge the dominant paradigm. And in my thinking, that's a good way to make a living, but certainly not the highest purpose of art, which I believe is to make change and revolution when necessary, irresistible. And as most of us know, it certainly is now. So what I mean by the never before seen is inherent in the word for in art for the sky. And that word for always trips people up, and they commonly refer to what I do when they describe it to others or printed in the media as art in the sky. And I'm always having to point out that no, there's no art happening in the sky. The art is on the ground and is for the sky. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. And their misinterpretation is certainly understandable because there's no history or any notion whatsoever of doing anything for the sky. Maybe the Nazca lines, you know, and some of the art that few people have done that's only makes sense from the sky. But we create national parks to protect wild and beautiful areas. We do reforestation projects for forests and declare certain areas off limits to cutting. We create wild and scenic river corridors and take out dams and curb industrial pollution to protect rivers. We create marine reserves to protect special places in the ocean. And of course, we have massive programs to protect endangered species and reintroduce them to the wild. But what do we do for the sky, for the atmosphere? Not a damn thing, not a zip. And we've been treating our atmosphere like a sewer since we started burning fossil fuels with no thought of the consequences. So, you know, our atmosphere, I call it our sky just because I like the word, and essentially that's what we look at and we're around all the time. That's the Earth's great commons. And our faulty perceptional psychology is such that we think we can pollute the commons and no one will notice and it won't have an impact. And, of course, it's a conundrum of a confounding sort, since the atmosphere is essentially invisible, and there's quite a lag time before our impacts are felt. And even then, most people dismiss their true cause. So the never-before-seen aspect I'm talking about when I use that phrase begins to arise through the collaboration again and again of thousands of people creating something that can't be bought or sold or locked up in museums, something that is too big and too chaotic to make sense of from the ground, something that's simply for the sky. This helps us, I hope, to create a sacred kind of mindset for seeing and doing something radically different than we ever have before, which is for the first time truly getting, truly understanding, truly perceiving that what we do to the sky, we do to ourselves. And if we could really understand that as a species, I think the world would become a whole different place. And that is essentially the never-before-seen, blinders-removed way of perceiving our world that would occur with our sky sight awakened in our species.
Yeah, it seems to me what you're doing in your work is you're kind of really blowing people's minds, particularly children, about the concept of oneness. In that, you know, we're all connected.
Exactly. I mean, the one thing, I mean, you know, it's hard to really get a grip on what children take away from the experience. I mean, I do a pretty elaborate musical film of each one that they love, you know, and they see at the final assembly. But the bottom line that I always want them to remember is so simple, and, you know, It's the famous Indian notion from Chief Seattle's famous speech. Mm-hmm. What we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And by extension, the sky, our atmosphere, is part of the earth. What we do to the sky, we do to ourselves. Just remember that. And if you can just get that and integrate that with those six teachings, then I think it's a powerful thing.
Absolutely.
You know, even as you were beginning to talk about art for the sky as opposed to seeing art up in the sky, my Facebook news feed comes up and there's a picture of the sky and written in the sky is the word sorry.
Really?
Wow.
That just came up just now?
Yeah.
2 minutes ago as you were starting to talk about that very topic.
Well, that doesn't surprise me because synchronicity has been a huge guiding force in my life, so I mean, we'll get around to talking to Apology, but maybe that's the segue for that.
Or the NSA is really, really powerful.
Before we go to the Apology, I want to pick apart something. I think differentiating art and craft, at least for me, art is created with a specific intent of changing somebody, and that differs from craft. Like, for example, people make guitars. And people call them artists because they make beautiful guitars. But I think that's craft, really. For me, at least, art is created with the specific intent of changing somebody's perception. And you sort of hinted on that with that last answer. Will you unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. I know totally what you mean. I mean, craft is lovely work done by artisans. And, you know, you could call it art, fine, but it's meant to be beautiful and functional in many cases. But true art does indeed, I think, have an intent to change. And my intention with Art for the Sky is definitely to change. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. I mean, that's what gives me the energy to keep traveling around so much and doing it over and over again. It's to change the way we perceive the world, which we have to do if we want to continue to live on this planet. And it's interesting to me that one-third of us have flying dreams. And I believe this ability to see the big picture, even in a literal sense, like we do when we have a flying dream, that it lives inside of us. It's an inherent kind of knowing that is asleep and just needs to be awakened. And it's my sense that it lives in that mysterious pineal gland that has been called and written about as the seat of the soul. And the pineal gland appears frequently in the esoteric literature and has been depicted in ancient cultures in hundreds of ways as the place where one can see beyond the physical plane. And as a way of setting an intention to awaken our sky sight, it came up with a sky sight sign, a symbol that kids love, which is two fingers placed over the third eye on one's forehead. And, you know, if you watch any of my films, you'll see hundreds of kids doing that, and it's a pretty fun deal. And so this place, two fingers over the third eye, this is the place of, if you're into chakras, it's the sixth chakra, the center of perception, where we interpret the data that we see. It's essentially the pattern maker and the code breaker, so to speak. And so at the end of each sky art creation, there's 1 minute of silence, which is quite profound, as everyone is all huddled together with their hands on the earth, heads bowed, backs to the sky, presenting the most color. And then on cue from me up above, they all rise up and scream to the sky as loud as they can, "Get your sky sight on!" And that's how, you know, that's how it ends. And yeah, they all, you know, and there's just so much joy released that you just have to be there to experience it. But our brains are amazing instruments and change in mysterious and miraculous ways, and that's what we need them to do right now. And this is the only thing I've been able to come up with that points us in that direction.
That's brilliant. You're listening to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. We're speaking with educator and artist Daniel Dancer. Daniel, you talk on your website, I saw, about sky art as a metaphor for change, and you talk about it with its relationship to quantum physics. I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit.
Sure. The need for us to belong, to be whole, seems to be at the heart of, at least for me, of the human experience. And is the essence, I think, in the magic of these gigantic collaborative living paintings that only make sense from up above. And watching them up above for so many times, it's really interesting to watch up there as each image comes to completion. Mm-hmm. And as order arises out of chaos, there comes a moment when the process becomes a metaphor, I think, for how change actually happens in the physical universe and in ourselves. And I remember reading one day in some book on quantum physics, I forget which, it talked about how when a critical mass of electrons arise out of chaos, align and bond together, a viola, an atom, is born. And physicists call this moment phase transition. And that's exactly really what happens when these images come together. On the ground, in the art, everyone, you know, can sense the sudden field of energy created when the image is all of a sudden perfect.
Yeah.
And then once it's released, once it comes apart, you know, then the joy and magic written on every face is incredible. And so in a sense, this form, the sky art form of phase transition, you simply might call it love.
Yeah.
And you know, isn't this transition the shift exactly that the world needs to make right now?
Absolutely. I mean, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of maybe the experiences and the reactions that you've had on some of the students over the years and some of the memorable things that you've experienced.
Oh, my God. They're so similar. And you know, I quit putting testimonials on my website, like, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, but it's just always off the scale. This last project I was at, we were doing a Viking ship, actually, in Illinois, and after the final assembly, you know, he's probably a fourth grade boy came up to me, and he was crying, saying it was the most incredible thing he's done in his life.
Wow.
And stuff like that is common. You know, kindergartners wake up and say that to their moms, "This is the most important day of my life. I'm going to be part of an alligator." You know,
yeah,
things like that. And teachers commonly say, you know, "In all my years of teaching, this has been the most, you know, exciting, important, collaborative experience." You know, it's over the top. Always. And it's just there's always tears when they see the final image in the video of there are 3-day events, and the last day I show the video of what they did and to music, and yeah, it's amazing.
It's got to be exhilarating and probably, I would imagine, emotionally exhausting after you leave an event.
Well, you know, it's not exhausting because it's actually the opposite. I feel extremely energized, like I've got some kind of super injection of love and appreciation and gratitude. So it's not exhausting because I've kind of got the whole thing down to a, you know, pretty workable, hate to use the word program, but I've, you know, like any artist, you get it, it looks really hard to somebody else, but you have your way of doing it and it, you know, always works. But
yeah.
No, it's extremely energizing. In fact, I can't see myself retiring because I think I would miss it so much.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm sure that it's so gratifying and rewarding and it's beautiful. So, and why would you stop, right?
Yeah, why would I stop? You know.
Right, and you have kids who think that being part of an alligator is a good thing.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, when I first heard about alligators, I thought being part of an alligator meant one ate me, and I didn't see that as being.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because when I do my introductory assembly, you know, part of it at the end is like I talk about that at the end we have 1 minute of silence before it ends. And I have them, we do an oath of silence where they all raise their hands up and they do this oath of silence that they promise to remain silent for 1 minute so they can awaken their sky side and tune into their interconnection with everyone in their school and all life on Earth. And then I ask them if they can do that, and they all say yes. And then I say, well, you know what I do if anybody talks? And then the next slide is an Art for the Sky image of an alligator and a tiger.
Perfect.
Yeah. As I feed you to my two favorite pets.
There you go. So do you work with adults as well? And you know, strictly, I guess, no kids involved at all?
Well, I have done a few projects like that, but mostly, I mean, I've tried putting it out to the corporate world as a way, not doing logos or anything like that, but doing something,
right?
And then having it being a covert way of bringing this notion of SkySight into their realm.
Sure.
And I've had limited success of that, but my most common population is elementary, middle schools, and of course all the teachers that are involved. And
yeah.
You know, I think it'd be great to do like the Bioneers Conference, everybody go out and do something. And, you know, there's a lot of possibilities for concerts and stuff, but I put a limited effort into trying to make that happen. And
yeah, sounds like you're pretty busy, so.
Yeah, I stay pretty busy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you recall the states you haven't been to within the last few years?
Yeah, if anybody's out there listening, I need to go to, I'm going to start from the east, Vermont, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Minnesota. I just been to Texas, that was on the list, I crossed that off, Arkansas, Mississippi, Nevada, Idaho, and Alaska.
That's not that many, actually.
No, it's not that many, it's doable, and I definitely can't. I'm going to have to give some super great deals to some of those states because I have this thing where I got to do all 50, of course. So.
Right. Well, I'm from Wisconsin, so maybe I can hook you up.
Oh, great. I mean, Wisconsin, Madison, you would think that'd be perfect.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's what I was thinking. As you were reeling those off, I figured they would be states that had some common demographic, but I don't see it in that list.
No, not at all.
No.
I mean, Vermont and Mississippi or Massachusetts. Yeah, no, there's not. I don't know what it is. It's just, you know, it just hasn't been their turn yet.
That's right.
Yes.
So, moving on, I've heard you speak briefly about apologizing to Earth without seeking forgiveness. After all, what civilized humans have done to Earth is unforgivable. Can you explain about the apology and where it takes you from an emotional perspective and if you invite the kids along for that ride?
Well, it's just, again, it's so synchronistic that on your Facebook page, the word sorry in the sky came up. I mean, you got to send that to me because that's pretty special. But, you know, it's like when in our human world, when we hurt somebody, it's a natural thing to apologize if we want to stay on good terms. And if we've been really bad, we give them a gift. And I don't think there's anything more important right now than for us to go out to our favorite natural places and apologize on behalf of our species for what we've done to the Earth. And on every inch of the planet, our impacts are evident in degradation or missing species. And each place can serve as a recipient for our spoken words. And I think it's important indeed to speak them out loud to really get the, you know, really get the true experience of it and feel the blessings that come from doing that. And I think that there are opportunities to do this every single day whenever we pause beneath a favorite tree or look up to the sky or walk along the beach, wherever we are. There's, you know, we could do it anywhere, direct our apologies anywhere, and they will hit home, as every aspect of nature, as we know or should know, is an ambassador for the whole of the planet. And for myself, I've found this apologizing in a very personal way without asking for forgiveness is extremely profound, precisely because it feels so necessary. And I'm, you know, I do it quite often. I do it more and more, especially when I'm out in, like I said, a favorite place. And I think at this point on our path, if there's any hope for personal redemption of ourselves and as a species, it lies in apologizing, just like it would in the human world. And so I just wonder if what would happen if this notion were to spread and everywhere everyone began to conduct acts of apology to the natural world, to the sky, to endangered species, you know, to all aspects of nature, what would happen in the makeup of the collective consciousness? I think it could be profound.
Yeah, I agree.
And as far as with the kids, you asked me about the kids, you know, I tell them that, okay, we're, you know, one of the aspects of these temporary sky art images that only make sense from the sky is that it's a thank you to the earth and sky for all the blessings that we get every single day. And it's also an apology to the sky and the earth for us being such poor reciprocators. And I think that I've noticed, I just started doing that in the last, about the last year. And I've noticed that that's had an impact on them. I really have, that they deep down feel inside that, yeah, we do need to apologize. And so I'm just trying to get that notion out there because it just seems so foreign to most people that you would go out and do that. And it just seems so obvious to me.
Yeah, and I think it's because of the separateness we've discussed already, that, you know, we don't have that concept of oneness. We think that's just a separate thing, and we, you know, or that it has, there's no life to it, that it's just something we use.
Right. Yeah, so why should you apologize? Because, you know, it's just our birthright that we can just take, and we don't have to reciprocate. Why would I think of apologizing?
But exactly. Yeah, I love what you're doing. I think that's a great thing to try and get people to catch on to. I mean, as I hate saying this, it might be a good hashtag for things people post. If we post things about the Earth and stuff like that, you know, a little hashtag that could catch on. You know.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the more we do it, the more it can spread. I think we just need to share our personal stories of, you know, of that. And, you know, I don't know how much time we have left, but I have a pretty good story of the last time I did that.
No, go ahead.
It was in Florida, and I just finished creating with a school two whooping cranes made of 1,000 kids, and the background for the image was 1,600 pairs of blue jeans, so that made the sky. And it was really beautiful, and I'd done a whooping crane with the school 5 years previous because the art teacher there studies whooping cranes and it talks to him a bit about the kids a lot because they're trying to restore them in the area nearby, and they every year they follow a flock of about 10 whooping cranes or 12 whooping cranes follow an ultralight, a couple of ultralights from Wisconsin down to this area in Florida, not too far from the school. So the day after the image, I was on a mountain bike ride. I was trying to find this place called the Cathedral of the Palms out in St. Mark's Wildlife Preserve, really huge area near Tallahassee. Okay. And I immediately got lost. And, of course, I had no idea or intention of finding any whooping cranes. I didn't know where they were. I wasn't even thinking about them. I was just going to this other place. But as it turns out, as I got lost and deeper into the Florida woods, which are so beautiful, I stumbled onto the secret spot of the whooping cranes. And there was a blind set up where people could come study them and monitor them, because they were in this out in this huge, huge meadow. There was an enclosure that they could fly in and out of, but they'd be protected from coyotes at night.
Right.
Which I guess had been a problem. So I sat up there on the roof of this blind and, you know, apologized to the whooping cranes at length. And it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. I really broke down and, you know, it felt really good. I shared the experience with children the next day at the assembly, and it was a very profound experience for everybody, and just really brought home that notion of how important it is to apologize. There they were, you know, endangered species, ambassadors for all endangered species, the whooping cranes that I was talking to, and, you know, it felt so good.
Well, that's a great story. Thank you for sharing it.
Yes, that's superb. Can you wrap up for us by telling us what you're working on now? What's the next chapter for you and for your work?
Well, you know, my next chapter, I just have a total faith in the unknown, and I don't try to, I just trust that I'm on the right, you know, in the flow, and don't try to, you know, project too far in the future. I know that I do want to do an image of, you know, like 50,000 people at some point, and I would like to have it to do with waking people up to the climate, to abrupt climate change, and I have a couple ideas in mind and just need a place and a gathering of people that wants to do it, you know, and yeah. I've kind of thought doing it at the Paris talks might be good, but I haven't really made any inroads in that direction. I think, what do you think, Guy? Do you think the Paris talks would be a good place to do something like this?
I think that would be an awesome place to do it. And like you, I don't have any inroads. But, it, you know, there's sufficient time between now and then that it seems you could be able to work something up.
Yeah, plus, I mean, yeah, obviously you'd have the people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder how many people will be at something like that. Any idea?
I don't know, but I mean, I think just the amount of people that are there involved, not necessarily maybe in the conference, but, you know, anything from protesting the conference to media, you name it. Boy, I've got to think that's going to be quite a gathering.
Right.
Well, yeah, there's going to be a couple, more than 100 countries represented, and that means it's going to be in the media on a pretty regular basis for the few days in December that they meet. So, you know, even if there's only a few thousand people at the conference, I think the reach from a media perspective is going to be quite broad, quite deep.
The reach would be broad, for sure, and that's one reason why the image itself has to be right, and one of the challenges of doing Art for the Sky in situations like that is you don't know exactly how many people are going to show up.
Right.
And so you don't know how to set up the image so that it works, where when I go into a school, I know exactly there's going to be 560 people,
right,
whatever. And so you can tailor the image to the size. If you were at the Paris talks and you planned out an image for 2,000 people and 1,000 people showed up, well, it wouldn't look very good. And
yeah.
So that's the challenge of doing it at events like that, where you just advertise it and say, come, we're going to create this really amazing image to wake people up. And, you know, you don't know how many people are going to show up. So that's the problem with if you could work with, if I could work with school kids in Paris,
right,
that would be a different story. You know, then the Paris schools could speak out, and that would be even a more powerful thing. So,
yeah, that'd be great. Yeah,
maybe I should try to focus on that.
Yeah.
So, if you guys have any Paris connections, let me know.
All right.
I'll see what I can think of over the weeks. I love the idea, though. I think it's brilliant. So, I'd love to help you try and make it happen, at least on some level.
Yeah, I have a really cool design in mind that would be so powerful, but I don't want to do it unless I know it's going to be done right. So,
sure.
Someday.
You hate to have the media show up for a complete disaster.
Right. I did that at Burning Man. That was my complete disaster.
That's all right. Sometimes you crash and burn, but it's how you learn. You keep going. So
right, it was a magnificent failure.
That's all right.
Okay, Well, that wraps up a wonderful interview with Daniel Dancer. You can catch Daniel's work at artforthesky.com. Thank you very much, Daniel Dancer, for joining us on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you. It was really great talking to you guys.
All right. Have a great one.
You too.
All right, Guy, what do we have for a climate update this week?
Actually, we have three tidbits worthy of mention. You can find all the details in the often updated essay on the blog, GuyMcPherson.com. First, carbon from terrestrial permafrost is entering the atmosphere, quote, at breakneck speed, according to an analysis published in the April 27th issue of Geophysical Research Letters. This result further explicates the danger identified in feedback number 12 on my long list of self-reinforcing feedback loops. Further corroboration for increasingly large waves breaking up Arctic ice, as initially reported in May of last year, is found in the March 27th issue of Geophysical Research Letters. And item three, the sudden onset of ice loss in Antarctica, which I mentioned on our last show just last week, is now large enough to affect Earth's gravity field. This according to a May 21st paper in the journal Science. And that's from the southern reaches of the Antarctic ice field, disappearing so fast now that it's actually influencing Earth's gravity. That's pretty amazing.
That is. I do think, though, after you mention these things, you should always tell people how far away football season is.
Maybe I should mention that before so I get their attention.
Yeah, that's probably good. Before and then after.
Yes.
All right, so since this show, first one on the air, you've been threatening people that you're going to share some of your juiciest emails, and so what do you have?
Yes, people often tell me I ought to read my hate mail on the air and then respond to it. So here goes my first attempt with some trepidation.
Okay.
Yesterday morning, shortly after I awoke, I checked my Facebook messages. Of course, that was a mistake. Here's how the dialogue with Eamon Alexander began, with a clever line from him, quote, "You are so full of shit." Apparently, Eamon was reacting to an interview with me posted at the People's Voice. It was published yesterday morning, and it's attracted quite the response online. And by quite the response, I really mean shitstorm. The interview is titled, "Capitalism Threatens All Life on the Planet." Of course, the title is misleading in a manner that we have come to expect. Civilization is at issue here, not the economic system of capitalism. But people have a tough time telling the difference. So anyway, if you go to the People's Voice and check out "Capitalism Threatens All Life on the Planet," you can see the interview. So my response to Eamon's full-of-shit comment was brief. "Good morning to you, too." And he responded with, "Did you wake up afraid of capitalism this morning?" And I wrote back, "No, did you wake up this morning?" And I realized that probably wasn't very nice. And then he said, "When I did, I wanted to throw up with the garbage you write. Must be a liberal. If you fear capitalism, why don't you move to Cuba?" Well,
wow.
I think that's an excellent idea. I would love to move to Cuba, but this is my duty station, as I've mentioned before. It's not really the country I love. But my response was more muted. "Perhaps you cannot read, I am not afraid of capitalism, but it's obvious you are afraid." So now I'm getting really pretty mean, and I deserve any hate mail I get. His response, "You might as well move to Cuba or even North Korea. They have it all figured out for you over there. I am sure you voted for Obama and think he is doing a great job."
Oh, God.
Wow.
This guy doesn't know you at all.
No. I wrote back, "Wrong again, not surprisingly. I'm an anarchist. I doubt you know what that means. But among other things, it means I don't support neocons in any form, including Obama and his ilk." And then I pointed out one of my favorite lines, "When you're dead, you don't know you're dead, but it affects other people. It's the same when you're stupid." And then I told him I'll be using this dialogue on my radio show in the near future. You might want to listen. And he writes, "And Al Gore is probably your fucking hero. Climate change is the biggest scam going, and you are right in the middle of it. I am stupid, right? I make more in a month than you make in a year, and I don't have to try to bullshit somebody to do it."
Ooh.
Oh, my. Were I prone to anger instead of absurdity, this might have been a good moment for me to get angry. Right. So he's a denier, actually, a complete denier of anthropogenic climate change. So I respond, "You're missing my point about anarchism. This is not at all surprising to me. And you falsely believe money equates with intelligence. I didn't say you were stupid. You did. Far be it for me to disagree with you, however. He writes, money equates to freedom, not intelligence. I was born into money, so I don't even need it.
Oh, God.
Let's talk about that for a second. But I don't want to
play it up. Culmination of every idiot we've ever talked to.
Yes.
Wow.
Back to him, you're very confused. I recommend you return to your comfortable state of ignorance. You seem quite annoyed by the facts. He says, facts my ass. They manipulate those statistics for their purpose. I've been around the block a few times. I've stopped now. I have plenty of hilarious material for the radio show. Eamon Alexander responds, you might impress people in Arizona, but they would eat you alive in New York. So go continue your worthless life. Thanks, I'm not interested in the apex of imperialism. Oh, it gets better. Let's see here. I am 28, and I have the world by the balls. I should be traveling the world and enjoying myself, but it bothers me when old geezer, like yourself, influence the funds with your agenda. And then he says, so if you don't want government, what do you want? Dictatorships?
Like we don't have one?
Right, exactly. And we call it government. We generally call it democracy. And then I said, anarchism is a vindicated, look it up. And then since I didn't think he'd bother to look it up, I copied and pasted the definition for him. I'm going to read it right here. Anarchism, noun, a doctrine urging the abolition of government or governmental restraint as the indispensable condition for full social and political liberty. And then I quoted one of my favorite lines from Edward Abbey that I never really grow tired of. Quote, anarchism is not a romantic fable, but the hard-headed realization based on 5,000 years of experience that we cannot entrust the management of our lives to kings, priests, politicians, generals, and county commissioners, end quote. After a considerable delay, of course, Eamon came back. Maybe he was thinking. He agreed anarchism is a good idea, but like most people I know, he simply cannot take responsibility for himself and his neighbors. He writes, 8 families control the world and own just about everything and everybody. Again, I point out the notion of personal responsibility rooted in anarchism. He couldn't wrap his mind around anything except money, thus failing to recognize that money lies at the root of myriad predicaments. The point here, I guess, is that the system marches on. People like Eamon, like most people I know, can't imagine another way to live, can't imagine a way to live beyond the monetary system that currently entraps us all. And so as a consequence, they believe money is the only answer to every question. I get a lot of messages like Eamon's. Maybe we can have this be a regular feature on the show. Anyway, that's the hate mail episode.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up this week, folks. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, speaking tours, and hate mail. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon live. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM. And rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to our guest Daniel Dancer for his work and to Afrozen for the music, Forrest, and Alexis for Breaking Hopium. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature, she's grown.